Welcome to the Wide World of Punting, episode 11, where we talk about everything and anything in the world of punting. I'm Jacob Wynn. Today we've got a big episode, a big chat over half an hour with a guy that if you follow punting or even if you're just on social media, you know who he is. It's Tom Waterhouse. Then I've got Tristan after that, and it's holidays. It's a bit of a shorter chat, more of a story time from Tristan. His origins on the bag. No, not what you're thinking. When he used to work trackside as a trackside bookie, so keeping that racing theme. And then wrap it up with the Wide World Bet of the Week. So first, here's my chat with Tom Waterhouse. Now, great thing about podcasts, you get to know the person a bit more. You get to know the backstory of people. But this isn't Tom Waterhouse's first ever interview, first ever podcast. I didn't want to ask him like all the same questions and the same origins. You still do get a bit of his background, maybe get to know him a little bit better. But as we are a punting podcast, I tried my best to try and get a bit more punting insight and steer the conversation more towards the actual art of picking winners and his thought process. Now, to set the table for where this chat picks up, my first question was about Tom's time working as a phone bookmaker. This was after he had transitioned from being trackside taking bets at the races themselves. And this is an interesting part of his career because even though he was a bookmaker taking really large bets from a variety of customers, he essentially was playing the punter as well in deciding which bets he was going to sit on and which bets he was going to try and trade out of. So I think you'll find that interesting. That's where we pick up.
And we used to have about 100 clients, and of those 100 clients, there were maybe like 10 that were very tough winning punters. And we used to guarantee those winning punters to win a much higher limit than what most bookies would let them. So we'd guarantee them to win anywhere between 20 to 100,000 on per bet. So they come to us first, and then we had access to Betfair, and we'd use Betfair as a guide, plus my dad's form. And if we liked the horse and the tough money was coming for it, we'd back it back for more than we let them on, or try to at the price, because thinking the market would firm. And if we didn't like it, we might keep some of it and lay it, or we just basically trade the tough money and go with the market or move the market. And then with our other 90 softer or more recreational clients, we used to bet them and bet them very big. And so we build up a clientele of tough punters because they knew they could get on for a large amount and get set. And we built up a clientele of big punters that knew they could have a big bet with us. And we were confident that we could take a big bet from them because we knew where the market was going. We had access to Betfair. We could lay off for a large amount. We also had my dad's form. So it was a really interesting period. And also we had all these overseas bookmakers coming to Australia, and they wanted to get market share, and so they were willing to bet a reasonable size amount. So in 2008, 2009, I had three bookies that would guarantee every bet to win $100,000, and now you're lucky for a bookie to bet you to win $1,000, the minimum bet rule. So it was a very interesting time for about a 2 or 3 year period, and then the market completely changed, and that trading business no longer was as lucrative as what it was for that period.
And that's why you could have the confidence. Someone wants to put $100,000 on a horse at $4. You don't have to think too hard about it because you knew, even if it was a great bet, you could put it straight back through some of the corporates.
My grandfather and my dad always say that you can judge how good a bet you're taking is if you can get off. If someone wants $100,000 on something at $4 and you can get rid of that whole $100,000, it's got to be a good bet because the market's willing to accept it. Where if someone says, oh, look, I'd like to have $100,000 on something at, and you think it should be $4 and they're happy to have $100,000 at $3, but you can't get off a cent, well, they go be very wary of that bet because you're obviously betting where the market is not liquid and you might think you're right, but there's a good chance that you're probably not.
And you just kind of shared why you needed to transition beyond that business once you couldn't offload those bets, once the other big bookmakers wouldn't allow you to do that. Can you talk about how you opened up Tom Waterhouse as the online bookmaker?
Yeah, so it was extremely lucrative or exciting time that because you had these this market where you could bet and trade large volume. So we were holding about $6 million a day. And we would bet back about $3 million of the $6 million. We plan to obviously and hope to win on our money we kept, the $3 million we kept. And we also had a positive expectation that we'd win on the $3 million that we bet back. However, the bookies, after a sort of 2 year period, went, well, we don't want the winning bet backs, and this bookie bet back, these bookie bet backs don't really suit us. And so we needed to build up a large retail online business. And we sort of started the build phase of that in 2009, soft launched in 2010, and started advertising in 2011. And that was a really interesting journey, because it was a shift from the bookmaking business that I knew and grew up with and was taught by my grandfather and my dad to a more marketing, digital marketing business, running an online business. And that was really an entertainment product, and trying to be a mass market entertainment product. And we were lucky with, obviously, the brand was known, the Waterhouse name, and that business grew really quickly. We went from 100 customers in sort of 2010 to by the time we sold in 2013, we had 250,000 customers. So it was a very, very quick growth period.
And speaking of that growth and marketing, I think a lot of people got real familiar with you around that time. Myself, I had a TomWaterhouse.com account, and I still remember you sprouted up, like, I guess, as you said, you had 100 clients, so you were relatively small, but you seemed to have a huge marketing budget. Like, your ads were everywhere. You had a presence on like Friday Night Footy and even other marketing strategies. Like, you had the $2 favorites, which was super appealing to, for people to get on at $2, a team that would have been $1.25 head to head. Was it like a bit of foresight you had that if you could really build your number of customers, that would build the value of your business? But I imagine with the amount of spend, was there a bit of risk involved that you get the return from it?
Look, I think we started off with not thinking of spending really any money. I went on TVN one time when my mum was on there, and we saw a spike in signups. We went, oh, actually, well, this TV might work. And then my brother-in-law was working at Channel 9, and they mentioned that they couldn't sell the rugby union, and this would have been Rugby Union World Cup, maybe 2010 or 2011. I'm not sure of the date of the World Cup, but whenever that was. And we bought that. It was sort of a distressed sale at the time, and that worked well for us. And so we had two things in our favor. We realized we had an advantage in that we were differentiated in brand. We're named after an individual, and also an individual that that had the background and history with the Waterhouse name. So that was a big advantage. And then the second, compared to like sports betting and TAB sports bet and sports bet, they all sounded quite similar. And that every time that I was on TV, I didn't actually have to say, keep mentioning the brand. The brand was myself as an individual who was the brand. So you got a free kick in a way of sort of putting it out there. And the other thing we realized is that live sport was really important during that period. And we just went, well, all these overseas companies are coming. Let's buy up as much live sport as possible. So we bought the NRL, the NRL regional, the AFL regional, the second spot on AFL Metro. We bought the tennis, Wimbledon, regional Australian Open. We bought the racing live. And it was generally quite cheap at the time. And so our marketing budget was dramatically lower than what our competitors was at the time. But one of the reasons why William Hill was keen to buy us, our cost per acquisition, so our bang for our buck of marketing spend, was several times better than what the competitors were in the market. And that was really those two things. We got a lot of live sport, which worked, and we had a brand that was differentiated and also polarizing. And so we were lucky in that we sort of found those two advantages and they worked well for us.
And let's keep talking about marketing, because you've got now a strong presence in social media. You're all over the place. So again, I think you're doing quite well in that regard. And you said the word there, polarizing. It seems to me you're but I'd love you to talk about the theory behind your current campaign with your new odds aggregator app that we'll talk about later. It does seem to me like you're not trying to get everyone necessarily to like you, but you're leaning into, I guess, just getting people to talk about you.
Yeah, I think in terms of marketing I explain to my kids in that there's everyone thinks they've got a great product, and people are so busy that even if you do have a great product, for them to look up and pay attention to it, you have to actually convince them why they need to go away from what they're doing or even look at a new thing. And just to say you've got a great product, well, everyone says that. So you've got to find something that gets people's attention and gets people talking about a brand or a business. And then you have to back it up, because like a brand is a promise kept. You've got to actually deliver on what you're saying, but you need to actually spike that attention of, oh, well, what's that person doing? Or why is that interesting? Or why have I got to look at it? And that's very hard, especially in an environment where everyone is got attention, low attention span. So a 30-second ad on TV used to work really well 10 years ago. For us and our business, TV advertising, 30 seconds ads don't have the same bang for buck as a 5-second thing on Instagram or on TikTok, you know, and that's just people's attention span is different. They've got so much going on. And so you've got to find something that is interesting and spikes their interest and spikes their conversation about it, and sort of the water cooler test. If your business and brand, they're not talking about it at a water cooler, you've got a long way to go before you get any sort of mainstream user base. And so we constantly think about what's interesting, what sort of ads are working, why things work, how you build a brand long term, and really just try and test and learn all the time about what the market wants and what they're looking at. And you don't have to win the whole market, but you have to get a certain segment of it and be very focused on what segment you want and really find a message that is interesting to them.
And speaking of growing a business, so you were acquired by William Hill, your bookmaker. And then I understand you took you were CEO of their operations, of the merged entity.
Sportingbet, Centrebet, TomWaterhouse.com, and then we all those three businesses merged into William Hill.
They brought you on. Was there any major changes you made, or what did you kind of bring to the business in terms of how you helped them operate?
Look, it was a really interesting journey, because obviously we were a small add-on. They paid $700 million for the Centrebet and Sportingbet business. And I was, I don't know, 30 at the time and had never really I'd run the TomWaterhouse.com business from being an on-course bookie to telephone business to online business. But it was a very quick journey in many ways and a steep learning curve. And I think one of the reasons why they asked me to take the role is that when you're doing a startup, you actually have to be across every little bit of the business, whether it's from marketing to finance to like customer retention and reactivation to IT. You sort of get a taste for it all. And so there were how that whole ecosystem fitted together. I think they quite liked that I'd been through that journey there and bringing these three businesses together. But at the same time, it was a steep learning curve to go from TomWaterhouse.com that had 250,000 customers and I don't know, call it a few hundred million dollars in turnover, to a business that turned over $2.5 billion and had 500 employees and over a million customers. It was a very different challenge. And so they bought a business that was a large turnover business, but was competing against Sportsbet that had double the team, double the marketing budget, and was growing at more than double our rate. And so we had to basically go toe to toe with them if we wanted to keep up. And that would have had an impact on profit short term. That was a very costly for the long term prospects of William Hill in Australia, that we didn't keep the pace up of what Sportsbet did in this market.
And I'll fast forward a little bit. I mentioned CrownBet before, but that was actually CrownBet then merged with William Hill, or I suppose the Stars Group acquired William Hill. And that was at the point in time where then you, I suppose, had a non-compete and you went down the road of sharing your own tips on a subscription-based model. And that's what I really want to dive into, because I also share tips. And I think the people that listen love to hear about the process of people who give out tips but have success beating the bookies. So can I ask a bit about you? I've heard you talk about your model, basically, that helps you determine the tips. And I hear you speak about true probability. So trying to figure out, using all your knowledge and your father's knowledge, or generations of knowledge, and obviously a lot of factors go into that. And I'd love to hear you talk about some of the factors that go into your model that help you basically figure out true probability of a horse winning a race.
Yeah, okay. Look, so the path was was fortunate enough, William Hill let me buy back the TomWaterhouse.com brand, and I had 2 years where I couldn't go into betting in Australia. And I thought, well, William Hill had such a large customer base, but the majority of people that bet are doing it as entertainment and recreation. They don't win. And I was lucky to grow up with my dad and my grandfather, my dad who's been a professional punter for over 40 years, and listening and understanding of how he approaches betting. But most people, there's no school for punting or no school for bookmaking. And I thought, well, if I can share those lessons, maybe that's a segment of the market that would be untapped. And so started this tipping business of trying to make our members better bettors and really share the process of what my dad does and what he's taught me. And that is that you've got to obviously do the form. So how we look at doing the form is that you think, well, what are all the different factors that you can think of, and has the market underestimated or overestimated any of those factors? So it might be wind, it might be track condition, it might be whether a horse has been held up, might be which, is there a jockey change, is there a gear change, is there, how fast did it run its last sectionals, how fast did it run its race overall, how long since its last run, is it up in class, is it down in class, it might be thousands of factors, and then seeing which factors actually there's the market hasn't estimated correctly, and what you think is, or what we think is, the true probability of that horse being able to win the race. So that's doing the form, coming up with the selection. And then once you've identified where the market's hasn't estimated the true probability, is then how confident are you? And when you realize, well, how confident you are, well, that's your staking. So how much of my bankroll am I going to have? 5% of my overall bankroll? Am I going to have 10%? Am I going to have 20%? Am I going to have 1%? So understanding how much you're going to have on it. And then the third factor is, okay, well, what price, how do I make sure that I get the best price in the market? Because the bookies have anywhere between 150%, so 50% against you, to 2 or 3% against you. And knowing when to bet and making sure that you're getting the very top of the 20 or 30 bookmakers that are betting, and making sure you're always getting at the very top of the market, has a dramatic difference in your profitability over the year. And so those are the three ingredients: coming out of the selection, staking your confidence, and making sure you've got as little percentage against you and taking the top of the market price. And that's sort of what we try and do with our subscription packages, is say, well, look, if you are disciplined and you follow these factors, the edge against you is much, much less, and your ability to beat the bookies is increased. And try and instill that discipline that my dad has instilled in me, and it's turned out to be well received and popular.
And I want to ask a couple more questions about the staking mentality and also pricing. But just back to that first element, the form, can you still dive into a little bit more? You mentioned a lot of those factors, like you'd obviously have a team, or, you know, you'd go back and watch replays, you'd watch trials. You mentioned it. A horse gets blocked for a run, it's in the wind, or it's in a really poor part of the track. Like, obviously a lot of factors. But I find that they would be quite qualitative. Like, it'd be very hard to build a percentage. So can you talk about how it's an art and a science?
Those qualitative factors, you need to put a number against them. Mm-hmm. So what does this, when a horse does that, what number? So everything has to have a number against it. So you can basically compute, well, what does that actually mean? Because if you're relying on me watching a video, oh, well, that horse was balked there, or this jockey didn't take the run here, or that, it's not to say you can't do it. There's plenty of people, and there's an edge in people that watch the videos and that analyze trials, and there's definitely an edge in it. The problem is that because you can only get on for the minimum bet rule, you need to turn over a significant amount of money on a significant amount of events to make a decent amount of money. And relying on my eyes, or one analyst's eyes, of just watching trials or just watching videos is very labor intensive. And so the way to be able to scale it is you have to say, well, this type of thing is a number and a factor that goes into a model, and then you can build it out and do it over tens of thousands of races rather than doing 8 races or 30 races a day. And if you said, well, look, I'm going to study this one particular race and I'm going to analyze the videos, and I understand betting and probability and all that sort of stuff. If you're just doing one race, you'll probably beat the computer teams. The problem is the computer teams over 10,000, 50,000 races, they will win, and they are over on scale. It doesn't matter that you got that one race right. And the problem now is on that one race, the amount that you can bet and exploit your edge has greatly diminished because the market's got smaller.
That makes sense. And so then you come out of your model with your true probabilities, and then I suppose you compare to the market, and that's where you identify which horses are value price and what you're going to give out. So when you share out your tipping package, do you share out like a minimum buy price or a minimum price that you need to back a horse to make sure you're getting value?
Yeah, we do. So we share with certain packages what the minimum price to take is. And that's really because on different packages, we feel we've got more edge, you know. So like on our best bet package, historically, we're winning over 10% profit on turnover at starting price. So there's a lot more leeway in how low you can go in taking the price. Where we've got other packages, which are just, if you can't get the price available when we tip it, you're not going to win. And that's really the difference in if you're getting, there's probably thousands of punters in Australia that can, if you took one tip from them a month, they would win a high profit on turnover. But if you ask those same thousands of punters, look, I want you to provide me 30, 40, 50 tips a week, very few of them, there's probably under 10 that could win, that could it's because basically if you're getting anyone's best tip and they're being disciplined just to stick to that, they're going to win. The problem with most people is that they don't have the discipline just to stick to their best selection. And they go, oh, well, look, I just love having a punt and the entertainment of it. And their 48th bet isn't staked accordingly in size to their best bet. And on their 48th bet, they're not going to win. And it's a little bit like that with our tipping packages. We only want to provide packages that you can win at, but there is a sliding scale of our best package and the leeway of how far you can take down the price compared to our 50th best tip. And that's why we provide the minimum price to take.
Can I ask about betting just win only versus each way versus the place?
So we have a few packages. Most of them are for the win. We have an early place package, which is sent out on a Friday for the Saturday races, which is the fixed odds to take on the place bets. And then we have a best tote the place price, where we generally pick sort of shorter price favourites, and we think that the variance across the three totes the place, there's an edge. But it's much harder betting the place for us. True each way, obviously, there's an edge for you in those fields under 10. To get on true each way is very, I think it's what's impossible at the moment to find anywhere that will bet you true each way. And the place market isn't as robust and as competitive as the win market. And so we find there's far less opportunities where we can find an edge for the punters to get on.
Sorry, can you explain what true each way is? And also, are you saying the place, is there a higher hold by the bookmaker? Is that why it's harder
there's
to beat?
There's a high percentage again. So they've inbuilt a lot more percentage into the place market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as competitive as the win market. And so we find it harder to find more as many opportunities for the place market as we do the win. And true each way is obviously where you bet a quarter of the odds. Obviously betting a quarter of the odds, you're betting a much different percentage to when they can just put as whatever percentage they want to in the place, you know.
Okay, so, I see what you're saying. And you mentioned best tote place. I actually noticed that as well a year or two ago. They were a lot more variable. I feel like the market has adjusted that, because I think you were tipping out something that I noticed there was an advantage in betting on favorites, best tote place, because a lot of other people weren't backing, like, say, $2 to $3 favorites to place. But on the tote, there was a variability across the three. And you might get, like, just as an example, you might get a $2.50 to the win horse that pays like $1.80 or $1.90 to place where it was in your favor. But it's less common these days, isn't it?
Well, what's happened is we found that edge and we went from, it might be six bookies betting best tote the place to, I think there's only one or two.
That's right. Yeah, they used to all do it. And that's why they don't anymore.
And that's why being a successful punter, it constantly evolving, because if you have an edge, let's say you've come up with a factor the market hasn't come up with, that edge only lasts a certain amount of time. So you've got to keep finding new factors and new markets, new bet types, new opportunities, because bookies don't want to lose. And so if you find an edge, the market will adjust over time, or other competing punting groups will also find that edge. And so you've just got to keep evolving and keep looking for new opportunities. And yeah, that best tote the place used to be a very popular product for our membership group. But now with only one or two bookies, it's far less popular. So we have to find another product that's interesting for them.
You know, there were bookies that were offering it midweek, and there were sometimes favorites that would win that would pay less than odds on, and the place best tote was actually a higher than the starting price to win. Like, so that was incredible. A huge opportunity.
And that's the same, like when we talked about the telephone business, there's always wrinkles in the market. They just get ironed out quickly, you know, so you've got to make hay while the sun shines, and you've got to find the opportunities and take advantage of them when you can. And then when they stop being there, you have to have the discipline to stop, you know, that's hard in itself to do.
Can you think of any other edges that come to mind in the past that like are now well-known or now factored appropriately, but you used to really benefit from?
7-day backups, like everyone used to talk about the 7-day backups all the time, and horses on the quick backup, and certain jockey and trainer combinations are always interesting, because you see like Nashville Willer and Gay, like I think you could back them for the whole year, and this is probably 15 years ago, and win at like the SP for a period, and you could back favourites in Melbourne in like 2010 or 11 all year long, and you showed a profit at SP, and how long do they you go? You've got to basically be monitoring it closely, and do they change, and do they become overbet? And that's what generally happens. You've got to keep finding new ones.
And another question I've got, because your subscriber base has obviously kept growing, have you noticed having a big impact yourself on the market, that the second that your tips get released, obviously everyone's jumping on, and then is that, you know, having a big effect of like smashing the odds in on some of your best tips for the weekend?
Yeah, so we basically try and find where it's where the impact of members betting in the market impacts the return. We normally change in price. So the early mail is a good example, is that there's no minimum bet rule when the Saturday early mail comes out. And the advantage is we're beating the SP by around 30% for that product, is that we try and limit by increasing the price. So that's a very good product. You're finding huge overs, but the price is very different to getting my five best tips on a Saturday, you know. And that's and really we try and make sure that we stick to a numbers that it's still viable, and if it's not viable, it becomes natural that they don't stick to it anyway, because you're not going to pay $100 a week for a package if you aren't getting benefit from it. And and you're not paying $15 or $20 a week for the same thing. If we can't find value for members, it sorts itself out, because people don't pay for it.
But what's with the minimum bet rules? Do the bookies have to take that days prior to a race? Is the issue that the people get a good price, but they can't? Can your members still get good bets on?
Yeah, so that it sort of becomes self-selecting. The people that can actually get on and find ways to get on, they might go to the tab, or they might go down to the local tab outlet, or they might have certain bookies that like they spread it around.
Mm-hmm.
For them, they'll go, oh, well, actually the Saturday early mail suits me. For people who can only get on the minimum bet rule, they're like, actually, well, I only want Tom's daily best bet, or I only want his gold package on a Saturday, or his silver package. It really becomes self-selecting of what you can get on and where you can basically exploit the edge, the tips are trying to give you.
And you've talked about this a bit throughout the interview, of course. You want to get the best odds, and I'm sure that was part of the genesis for your new app, which has come out in the last few months, which allows which aggregates prices across a number of the big bookies to allow someone to not have to shop around themselves, just get the best fixed price. Can you talk about coming up with the app and how it works?
Look, I've always loved Dynamic Odds. I thought the job that the team there at BetMakers, Carl and the guys have done, I've just been a huge fan of that business for a long period of time, used the product and just thought what an amazing product and tool that it is. And the members always were saying, well, how do I get the best price? And we tell, well, you have to use Dynamic Odds and you have to look for the best price and open accounts with them all. And really thought, well, how do I make it easier for them and building that sort of functionality into the app? And that was really where the conversation started of, look, how can we leverage and utilize the Dynamic Odds BetMaker technology and the expertise that Carl and Todd and the team have got and be able to give that that advantage and that functionality to our members in an app-style product. And that was sort of the thought process of really, when we're thinking about stuff to go into the app, does it make our members better bettors? And we thought that was a no-brainer because you're allowing them not to only get the tips, but be able to go straight away to whatever race they want and sign up with one username and password across multiple bookies and bet within the app. And that was really the thinking around it.
So people just deposit into your app and then your technology disperses it to the other bookies?
Yes, no. So they've got it to be deposited into the different bookies.
They've got to have those accounts funded.
Yeah, they can sign up and use the same username and password in the app, but they've obviously got to have each betting account funded. And obviously just try and make it as seamless for them as possible to bet across their different accounts and making it really quick and easy to do so.
And it would be fixed odds. Like, do you ever advise people to take top tote for the win and then which bookie would that place it with?
Generally, we say, well, taking the fixed odds is best course of action to take the fixed odds. But there's several of our products that you win at best of the best, like best of best tote and fixed price. And we do recommend them sometimes if they can't get on to use that product if you can't get the fixed odds at the time we tip them.
And any plans to further evolve your app? I mean, I'm a bigger sports punter, so I think that a similar type product, if you could get best fixed odds on sport, would be ultra appealing as well.
We really like focusing on racing because we know it so well and we feel we've got an edge in that area. I think the next thing will be having it where it goes from tip. They get the tips and they can just click straight away and bet through at the best price. I think that will relieve a lot of pain point for our members. Just trying to make that ease of experience and that integration with the bookies, that it's just as seamless as possible for punters to have a bet.
Well, I echo the sentiment, of course, of people want to be winning as much as they possibly can. And look, a vast majority of people punt to have fun. But I always say it is more fun if you can win a bit more often. And if you wins, when you do win, you get paid a little bit more. So I definitely advise people to give the app a shot. But I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today, sharing your valuable time and your knowledge as well. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jacob. Thank you.
Now, I know Tom is a polarizing character. He said so himself in the chat, but I do appreciate the opportunity that I get to interview some high-profile people, and when I do, it's only thanks to having the audience that you guys are a part of and that you guys get around the pod. And I do feel the responsibility that if I can get a big guest that is an interesting person on the show, then it's up to me to try and get some good stuff out of them. And I hope I got some. I think I could have done better, but I'm still trying to get better each week as well. But I hope you got a bit out of that. Next is Tristan. He's on every week, and I said, let's do a little bit shorter. You're on holidays, and I've got this bigger chat. So kept it racing themed if there's people who are tuning in who don't usually this week. Talking about Tristan's origins, where he also began his career on the racetrack, and he had a couple of stories and talking about the difference between working trackside as opposed to in an online bookmaker.
I started working for him when I was about 14 or 15 at school. I used to field on the bag on a Saturday, and that was around about 2000. So I would have fielded from about 2000 to 2005. Dad was from about 1985 to 2005, so there was a lot of different stories. I love my time on course. I love going to the races still. Obviously, with COVID, it's sort of changed a little bit over the last little bit, but there are some key differences, like one of the big ones, and I guess that's where our roots of trying to be fair in every bet we take is that if you're on course and someone comes up to you have a bet, you have to explain to them or justify them if you're not going to take the bet in full. And that's what I always tell our guys that come and work for us and trade, that you need to be able to, if someone's got an issue with the decision you've made, you've got to be able to articulate why you've come to that decision. Because if you're standing on course and you've got a horse at $5 and someone comes up to have $100 on it, and for whatever reason you don't want that bet, you've got to be able to explain it to them. Where sometimes I feel some of the bigger operations that, you know, have these very minuscule limits on certain events, if they were forced to justify, or the traders were forced to justify those decisions, it might be a different sort of setup. So that's one of the key differences that, you know, and sometimes the punters that come up to you may have had a little bit to drink out there at the races, and it can get a little bit fiery at times. But I feel that's where your skills of, you know, being able to communicate your decisions and offer a fair product and be confident in your prices, so you're always able to take a strong bet at all times. You know, people coming up, yeah, no idea what they're about. Do they own this horse? Are they a big punter? You know, are they a big professional? Are they in a syndicate? Was trying to make these decisions in a split second, whereas, you know, when you're bookmaking online, you've got a lot of account history to be able to identify the trends of customers, you know, for a long period of time. I guess it's like when you get a new account and someone starts firing big bullets at you, you don't know a heap of information about them. But, you know, that was all part and parcel with it. You had to probably back your prices. You had to be more opinionated on what you wanted to do, and because you probably didn't get the ability to lay as many runners on course as what you do online. You know, you were in a position where you'd probably put one in and you'd say, well, this is a horse I'm going to stand for the race, and then you'd be hoping it got beat. So that were probably the key differences from being on course. When I first got my license, I was only 18, so I wasn't the most experienced person, and I was down at a little track called Border Park, and we were there packing up for the day, and there was only two bookmakers on course. There was no one around. And I remember we were packing up the cash, we were closing up the computer, and I just noticed there was someone just wandering around the background, and I'm like, what's going on here? And he had this baton, and he was smacking it in his hands just in the shadows. And I've sort of seen him out of the corner of my eye. I've tried to nudge the baggie. I'm like, let's try to pack up a bit quicker. We were the only ones left on course. The club secretary at the time came out and actually climbed up on his ladder to switch the lights off, and I've sort of got his attention. I said, oh, what's this bloke doing over here? And he just shrugged his shoulders and off he went. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be a nightmare. And I was convinced we were about to get robbed. And anyway, I remember it was probably only a 5-minute window when we were packing up, and it just felt like we were there for hours. And I saw this guy, he was wandering over, still smacking the baton into his hand. And it just felt like every step I could feel my pulse racing. And then he came right up to the stand and he put his hand out. He said, mate, I'm the new security guard. I still remember to that day I was in cold sweats. I was convinced it wasn't going to end very well. But that was the different element to bookmaking on course in the sort of more smaller rural tracks where we started out. And we made sure we became well aware of all the security guards from that point on. But it was a different experience, and one luckily we don't have to handle too much when we're in the office.
Could you give us an idea of like how many dollars you would like have on a typical day, how much you would handle? Are we talking thousands or tens of thousands?
Yeah, like on a day, like a normal day, you probably had to have about 30,000 cash in your bag. So there was a significant amount. On a Magic Millions day, like, you know, back in the big days, when back in the early 2000s, when it was predominantly cash, and I'd imagine things have changed back then. You know, I know it wouldn't be uncommon for Dad to have over 100,000 in the bag, that, you know, you'd have to make arrangements on course to get that out and get security and all those sort of things. So because the thing is, like, when people are betting in cash, you have to be able to pay people out if they win. And I know things have changed, obviously, with AusTrack, and it's a hell of a lot different these days. I wouldn't even know what people bring out to the track these days. But that there was a significant amount, and particularly, as I said, I was 18 back at the time. The one of the funny stories, actually, when I was a patron on course, I was in Ireland. My wife's Irish, and we went over to the races in Ireland. And this was one thing that stuck out of my mind, and I never wanted to be in this position as a bookmaker. We were there and must have been a bad day for the punters. We weren't betting that big. My wife was having a 5 and 10, 20 euro on horses. And I remember, come the last race of the day, the bookmaker had to get on his stand and he said, okay, I only want the females to come up and collect here. I haven't got enough money to pay everyone out. I'm going to have to come back next week, so we're going to handle the smaller bets first. I've never been in a scenario, luckily myself, where that's been the case. But obviously, things were a bit different over in Ireland at the time, and that would just, you know, you just want to make sure you never put in a position.
Well, that was the other question that came to mind for me. So you're talking about whether or not you'd accept a bet. Like, was that, did that factor in like how much liability you could have in any given race based on literally how much cash you had with you, so you didn't get yourself in that situation?
Yeah, well, I suppose the vast majority of the bigger bets when you were on course still, they were people that bet with you regularly. Obviously, there's odds track requirements where you, you know, you can't pay out over 10,000, has to be a check and these sort of things. So there were protection mechanisms in place, but you know, if someone got it a run and they were betting in thousands and those sort of things, you'd have to set them and you had to make sure you weren't in a position where you overcommitted. Now, you can always pay someone in a check back in those days, or there was opportunities to go over the tab. So it's just like anything. Like, obviously, you don't bring all the cash on your bankroll, so it's more a bankroll management sort of situation. But you know, back in those days as well, we obviously weren't anywhere near the size bookmakers we are today. So it's all relative. Like, you know, it's the same as now. Like, we will only stand things for what we're comfortable standing in and for a percentage of. But yeah, like we loved our time on course. You know, I'd jump at any opportunity to field on any racetrack. Like, by the same token, I don't want to be seen to be coming onto the turf of the people are there every week for those bigger meetings. We've had plenty of opportunities to field on course on some of the bigger days, but I don't feel that's right when, you know, the other bookies are there week in, week out, and then their big day is their big day. So I think you've got to be respectful of everyone in the industry, and they play such an important part for our great game, the people on course. It adds that vibrancy. It adds the it adds to the atmosphere, and it's such a great experience seeing a big rail. So I remember back in the day there was 40, 50, 60 bookmakers on course, and unfortunately as we were finishing up, the numbers obviously dwindled, and that just goes with the times. But it's something I'd love to see an initiative to try to bring people back on course, to help the on-course bookmakers, and to really sort of create that atmosphere again.
It must have been quite exhilarating for punters too. Like, they know what horse they're going to back, and they go into the ring and they'd be looking at every board to see who's got the highest price on the horse that they want to jump on. And handling real cash almost makes it even that more exciting. But
touching on that point, the atmosphere, like, you know, sometimes I know people will see horses or footy teams shortening and the market's moving, and it's sort of like an anonymous move. You don't know what's happening. Whereas back on the day, you'd know the runners, they were called people that would be betting for the big syndicates and the professional punters, and you'd see this guy running along the rails backing this horse with every bookmaker, and then other people would be flying in. It was just brilliant seeing how those sort of things would happen. You know, he's starting up the end backing the two, so someone's trying to jump in front of him, and yeah, it was just a phenomenal sort of experience. And yeah, it has changed, but you know, it's just one of those things that'll live in the memory banks.
The good old days, eh? Well, thanks for the little trip down memory lane. That was a cool couple of stories, and hearing the differences for those of us that, you know, didn't experience that era firsthand. Thanks again to Tristan. Okay, bonus story time. I didn't even tease this in the intro, but I should share it. It's my own story from the racetrack, and it's a shit story, but I want to share it with you guys because it was actually at Magic Millions, and I was with a group of blokes. I can't remember if it was just a boys trip or a Bucks weekend. I didn't know like half the guys that well, but I do recall our master plan. There was 8 of us, and we decided to pool our money into a syndicate of sorts, $100 each, and 8 lads, 8 races, and each one of us got given one race where they could bet the whole kitty. So $100 per lad per race, and we had absolutely no luck. First 7 races, not one winner. Comes down to the final race of the day, was up to yours truly. So I've had a look, I've picked whichever one, let's say I've picked number 6, was paying right around 9-1, so close to win $1,000 with $100 on. So obviously tell all the boys, all right, this is what we're on, this is what we're cheering. We all go down to the winning post, and this of course was backed at a bookie on course, so it was a paper ticket. So I've just stuffed the ticket into my pocket. Just before the race jumps, I've just felt into my pocket to grab the ticket, and I can't find it. And I'm kind of scrambling around. I'm thinking, oh, shit. And I'm reaching in. I think I've pulled my phone out and I've, like, flipped the ticket out and the ticket's gone. And I've just felt this sickening feeling in my stomach. But literally, as I've noticed, that is when the race jumps. So I don't have time to, like, tell all the boys, oh, shit, I've lost our $100 bet. So instantly, I'm just thinking, well, it doesn't matter as long as this thing doesn't win. So now I'm all of a sudden thinking, anything but the number 6 get up here and then not to worry. So what do you reckon comes via the cape at the end and storms past them and has all the boys up in arms? My pick number 6. And they're all cheering and, like, you know, bumping into me and celebrating with me. And I've just gone white as a ghost and had to tell them that I lost the ticket. And half of them, I reckon, calling bullshit, thinking I've kept it to myself. Felt absolutely sick. You know, this was years ago. I didn't have that much money. It never crossed my mind to say I'll cover the winnings. And the guys were just had the shits with me for the rest of the day. And I've honestly never recovered from that feeling, but I thought I'd share it with you guys. And now it's what you've all been waiting for, or maybe you haven't, quite frankly. After the last 4 weeks, the Wide World Bet of the Week has come up short. Last week was a five-leg American football multi, two college teams and three NFL teams. And look, one 4 out of 5, but the one that lost was a $1.33 favorite that lost by 3 touchdowns. So I'm not going to say I was unlucky at all. I got it completely wrong, trusting Clemson at such a short price. And they got their pants pulled down, and I got mine as well. And to be a bit more candid about the Wide World Bet of the Week, when we came in to start Wide World of Punting podcast, I had this kind of thought that, look, I want to vary it up. I want to come up with some creative best bets, and I also don't want to go too long without winning one. And I really felt like I've got to at least come up with a winner every month. Now, we started in October. We did have a winner in October. We had a couple of winners in November. We did have a win in early December. And here we are in January, and we're searching for that elusive January 2021 Wide World Bet of the Week win. And it's going to be NFL again. We've got the NFL playoffs, and for the first ever time, they've let 14 teams into the playoffs, but 12 play in week one, wild card weekend. This was used to be always a wild weekend when there were 4 games. Now there's 6, and I haven't completed my deep dive. You're going to have to wait till Saturday for my breakdown of all 6 games. But I needed to come up with a bet to incorporate these games. Once again, we've got action on the Aussie weekend. It's not all on Monday in Australia. There's games, a triple header on Sunday in Australia as well. And that's where this bet will begin. It's going to combine the first game of the weekend and the very last game of the weekend. And the bet simply is the Indianapolis Colts to score more points than the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, you may be thinking, but Pittsburgh's a, you know, a Super Bowl contender and they're a favorite, whereas Indianapolis are an underdog, so why do we want a team that's probably going to lose to score more than a team that's probably going to win? And there's a few reasons. I'm going to put up Indianapolis's recent scores. Now, first, let me say they won 11 games this year. They are actually a really good team. If they hadn't choked one or two away, they could have been an even higher seed and they wouldn't be on the road right now against Buffalo. But what you will really notice is high scoring games. This offense is really clicking. They've got a new quarterback, Phillip Rivers, in the system this year. They really seem to improve wide receivers. I mean, they drafted Pittman, Pascal playing well. T.Y. Hilton is turning back the clock. And this Jonathan Taylor is a revelation. So what you're noticing in their games, even with ones whether they lost or won, is high scoring games because the defense came out gangbusters. But the defense, to be honest, has regressed. So for Indianapolis to be competitive with teams, they're an aggressive side that needs to play in high scoring games. They're playing Buffalo. And look, Buffalo certainly are no mugs on defense. But Buffalo is a high-powered offense. They're really, really strong across the board, as I've noted a number of times this year. And look, hands up, I bet against Buffalo in the best bets on Monday. While we did go 8-5, Buffalo didn't even need to win. And they still scored like 50-something points against Miami that was playing for their season. So you look at this game, and it's the highest total of the weekend. And I think with good reason, I think it's going to be a shootout. And I think Indianapolis can push Buffalo all the way. They won't let them have it all their own way. Now, you fast forward through all the games, get my thoughts on them on Saturday, come down to the Sunday night football, which is around midday on Monday in Australia. And we've got division rivals. We've got the Cleveland Browns, who haven't been in the playoffs for 20 years, against Pittsburgh Steelers. And this is a game I think will be more of an, much more of an old-fashioned, physical, you know, smash mouth, on the ground, in the trenches type of game. I really feel, and I'm going to put up Pittsburgh's recent scores, and what you notice is they're not nearly as high-scoring games. They're a good defense. I would say they were great before injuries, but their offense is just really, really inconsistent. Big Ben, he's going to be fresh. He got sat out last week, but man, they don't throw it too deep down the field. They can't run the ball. The whole offense is predicated on a lot of short passes, whereas Cleveland is a team that I think is going to push them to the wire. Now, this game's in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh are a favorite, but Cleveland's got a pretty stout defense. They've got a very strong run game, and I think this game can be close and lower scoring. That's why I've gone with Indy to score more points than the Steelers. We're getting $3.50. Now, if you just want to look at what their team totals are set at, Indy's expected to score 21 to 22 points, Pittsburgh 24 to 25. So we're an underdog, but I think Indy can get to that 24 or above range. I think by the time this game is played on Monday, we might be more like a 50-50 chance of cashing our $3.50 ticket. That's why I'm making it my Wide World Bet of the Week. And that'll do it for another week, guys. Now, if you are into horse racing, which the, you know, this podcast prominently featured, next week we've got a bit more race. We've got Benny Thomas from the Dark Horse tipping group, and Magic Millions coming up. So getting someone else with some knowledge, he's going to share some tips, and who knows what else. Benny Thomas, a bit of a loose unit, but there'll be a more diverse range of topics next week. I do this show every week, and I've got another 5 weeks to bring it home strong through January through to mid-February, just past the Super Bowl. I'll be bringing this show out, and I want to get you guys involved and your feedback and interact with you guys and get your guys topics as well that we can cover. So please share with me what you want to hear about, who you want to hear from. As always, good luck with the Wide World Bet of the Week. Happy punting, and always do it responsibly. Lego.